helps if you put the tape in first.
1 second. Three.
Go two, ahead. Go ahead.
One.
Linoleum knife, and filling in both as co-host and as handler of the crappy old boombox is a dear friend of the show, James Rocky. Welcome.
Hey, Alonzo. Thank you very kindly for having me.
Oh, we are thrilled that you could be here. Dave White is in Dallas this week, so James has graciously agreed to step in. I'm Alonzo Duraldi, film critic for The Wrap and What the Flick. James writes for MSN Movies as well as Box Office Magazine and Movies.com and the Toronto Star. So we barely deserve to have such a distinguished guest today.
I'm a gentleman freelancer like you, sir. That's all I am. That's all I'll ever be.
Oh, stop.
Big week at the movies, but not if you like good films, it seems.
Yeah, not so much, and we neither of us even saw Immortals, which I heard was also kind of a letdown. But
the thing about Immortals, which I nearly called Immortals.
Immortals,
which sounds delicious.
I was going to say it's a chocolatey treat.
The new eternal treat from all the dudes in Hershey. I didn't see Immortals primarily because Tarsim's one of those guys who seems like the junior version of Tim Burton. Or even Baz Luhrmann, where
right.
It's a case of a really talented set and production designer being promoted completely beyond their core competency and into the realm of telling stories.
Right, yeah. Like, my impression from the films of his that I've seen are like, wow, these would be gorgeous coffee table books.
Right.
But where's the movie? You know?
And that, I'm afraid, from a producer of 300, does not inspire confidence in me. 300, the most violent homoerotic series of oil paintings ever displayed on a motion picture screen.
Oily oil paintings.
Very oily oil paintings. I mean, yeah, just fairly risible. So going for that look does not endear me to your film. So, and you saw Jack and Jill.
I did see Jack and Jill, and we'll get to that.
Right.
But yeah, so the big movies this week... J. Edgar opened, and Lars von Trier's Melancholia, which
right.
has been available on pay-per-view, is now in theaters in some cities, I guess. So I take it you were not enamored with any of these.
No. I'm remarkably fond of Melancholia.
Oh, okay.
Melancholia, after Antichrist, it was really good to see Lars von Trier back in an empowered and powerful storytelling groove. Mm. In that Antichrist, while visually striking and full of rough stuff, doesn't quite tell as complete a narrative as I think it needs to really make an impression of the film. Antichrist feels like somebody who had clinical depression saying, I'm going to make a film, so I'm going to work my way through it, and not quite doing either.
I got to say, von Trier is one of those guys who bugs the crap out of me, for the most part. And I just feel like... and I haven't seen everything, so I can't, I can't lay it out on all the ones. But of the movies that I've seen of his, I find his worldview so... not even pessimistic, it's like so disdainful of humanity, I guess, that, you know, I did not drink the Breaking the Waves Kool-Aid. I did not
right.
like that movie at all. Antichrist drove me up the wall. Dogville, really the last film of his I think that I genuinely liked was Zentropa.
Okay.
And this was the first film since then that I was like, wow, I like this. I get why people, you know, are so crazy about him as a filmmaker, and this actually says something to me without making me feel like I need to go take a Silkwood shower.
Right. And the whole, I think Von Trier is like Neil LaBute or David Mamet in a certain way, in that he's a misanthrope who's confused as a misogynist, and he's not even that much of a misanthrope in that he just believes so fiercely we could do better that it makes him furious.
Hmm.
And I feel that way about Mamet. I feel that way about Neil LaBute.
I would put French guy, piano teacher, Michael Haneke. Sorry, not French. The Austrian director
right, Haneke,
in that category.
In terms of being permanently let down by us.
Yes.
And making films that explore that failure, which I think is really interesting. And also,
it can be, but it can also be scoldy as hell too.
Well, I mean, AFI was recently here in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you saw Michael, the debut film from Mr. Haneke's casting director.
Oh no, I did not.
And it's predicated. It's based around a true story of a man who kept a 3-year-old boy in his basement as a sex slave.
Ew.
And so you just have like, wow, Austrian sex basement, and you never see the sex.
Thank you.
But it raises the whole question about ugly art, which is, I view ugly art as wrapping paper. The question is, what's inside?
Sure.
If your ugly art contains the insights into the human condition of a Michael Haneke, if it contains the insights into film viewing of Funny Games, then wrapping paper is worth it. If a wrapping paper is Human Centipede 2, it's not.
Right, yeah. I mean, if you're going to drag me through the mud, there better be something on the other end of it, basically.
Exactly.
Although, I, you know, Funny Games, I felt like I was being punished for wanting to see that movie, which, frankly, I didn't even want to see it. So, you know.
A lot of people feel like that about Funny Games.
I also made the mistake of watching the original and the remake 2 nights in a row, which was really not something that I would recommend to anyone.
Well, it was really funny. The first time I saw the remake, it was at midnight at Sundance at the Egyptian. Whoa. And there are two interesting things. The one was that Scott Foundas, ex-film editor of LA Weekly and currently with Lincoln Center.
Lincoln Center, yes.
Was standing there, and I said, oh, Mr. Foundas, it's always a good sign to see you here, because Scott has exemplary taste. And he smiled, and he said, this is the third time I've seen it. Yeah. The other thing is that at watching the remake at the Egyptian at Sundance, there's a big turn in the film, which I'm not going to state for those of you who haven't seen it. But a lot of people in that midnight crowd were like, whoa! And I was like,
really?
How are you here if you haven't seen the original?
I was going to say, how does that, I mean...
Are you that much of a Naomi Watts fan? Does Tim Roth get you out of the theater that fiercely? Oh, midnight, gotta be there for a roster.
Well, I'll tell you though, actually, speaking of the Funny Games remake, an actor who I'm really just constantly amazed by, who I think has not been getting a lot of credit, and who turns up in Melancholia, is Brady Corbett.
Brady Corbett, great in the Funny Games remake. Great in Melancholia.
And in Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene.
Very, very good stuff.
And Mysterious Skin. I just think this guy's a real up-and-comer, and I don't know if it's because he's attractive, and that means that people just sort of want to put him in the category of, like, you know, this year's model or something, but I think this is a guy to really be on the lookout for.
He does really, really strong work. Actually, I think his friend is Corbet.
Really? Okay.
I think he corrected me on that in kind of like warm yet douchey fashion when I interviewed
him. Corbet it is then.
Really Corbet.
Like sorbet.
The other thing about Melancholia is that it's bold. It's really bold.
Yes.
It opens with that 18-minute long or however long it is symphonic suite with painting-like images taken from the film or extrapolated from a film featuring the actors. And after that overture, you go into a 2-part film where one part is a wedding and the other part is the end of a world. And I mean, not to keep playing that one note on the bass, but this might very well be the best depiction of clinical depression ever caught on screen.
Oh yeah, no question. I think it, but not in a way that feels showy, you know,
or forced, right? And the ridiculousness of a metaphor brings everything home. For Kristen Dunst's character, the end of the world is just one more goddamn thing to worry about.
And she feels fine.
And the other thing is that I know Melancholia is on video on demand, but if you're out there in Radioland listening, see it on a big screen.
The images are stunningly gorgeous, and it really does. It is a movie that merits, you know, it's like, you know, see Harold and Kumar in 3D and see Melancholia on the big screen. You know, there are treasures to be had.
Yes, In our see it on DVD age, the idea of waiting for it on video. I was at the premiere of Tintin on Thursday night, and I thought, boy, love this movie or hate it. If you say, oh, wait until DVD, then America, you're why we can't have nice things.
I'm seeing that next week. I'm a little trepidatious about. I will call it Tintin. I was stuck in a conversation with somebody who kept calling it Tintin, which is probably correct, but please.
Right. I'm going to insist on calling it The Adventures of Tintin, The Secret of a Unicorn.
There you go. So you even say the word colon in the middle. What worries me about it, and we're not going to get into a discussion of this, but you can just tell me, does the mocap work? Because that's always the deal breaker for me, the rubbery dead faces of motion capture.
The mocap works better than it has. The Adventures of Tintin, Secret of Unicorn, is the first film with mocap where I've actually seen potential instead of a potential for potential. In that, at one, while the faces don't look great, Right. Or now and then, or things don't fall right, which is my big problem with mocap, capturing gravity with it.
Oh, yeah.
At the same time, like, you can see Captain Haddock's nose hairs. You know. You
great!
Can, well, no, I mean...
no, 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 I get what you mean.
And at one point, Spielberg takes the camera through the cannon port of a 50-cannon sailing ship in the 17th century, up through three burning decks, across the burning main deck, through various fights, up the mainsail... to a big fight where our protagonist cuts a rope that unhooks two ships that have been lashed together, and the two splash apart as the camera pulls back to capture that in all of its majesty against a rolling sea and against a wine dark sky. And you're like, yeah, I can't do that with a camera.
No, I mean, I believe in the potential, like we were saying, of mocap, and I think that it works in... in situations where you don't have to necessarily buy the characters as human, like Avatar,
right?
Seamless,
don't know how those gorgeous. Move.
Yeah, and the eyes don't have to be the same, and you know, there's, you know, that, so that worked great. And even to, I would even say Zemeckis's Beowulf worked for me,
despite its risible script.
Well, yeah, yeah. I mean, it has other problems, but in strictly in terms of the mocap, like though I wasn't looking at those characters and feeling like they were giving me the creeps, unlike Polar Express, Christmas Carol, Mars Needs Moms, where they're just where they're
full of drowning victims.
Exactly, where they're all kind of bloated and puffy. And
I would really like to see mocap more as a garnish than a full meal. Like if you could use mocap to just hypothetically put a Jack Kirby design of the Thing into the Fantastic Four film.
Oh, that would be awesome.
That would be terrific. But surround them with real human beings in a real world.
Sure.
Where you're not constantly looking like, okay, everybody looks dead. We're digressing here.
You're right, yes.
Melancholia, I would say, gets both of our endorsements.
Absolutely, no question, no question. Also opening this week is Clint Eastwood's J. Edgar, starring that guy, Leonardo DiCaprio.
Armie Hammer, Naomi Watts. It's filmed with a new technique called emotion capture. No, I'm kidding. I'm not sure how you felt about J. Edgar, but I was table-flippingly mad at it.
I didn't even get that... roiled. I was just sort of bored, and it felt like a lot of things. I didn't like Milk, and I think that the problem with Dustin Lance Black's historical biopics, now that I've seen three of them, including Pedro, the TV movie he did about Pedro Zamora, is that he never really gets to the heart of who these people are, and instead just gives us this sort of parade of events. So that's a problem. You've also got the problem that I never stopped thinking that I'm watching Leonardo DiCaprio do an accent and wear makeup, and I never lost myself in him as a character. And because Hoover was so secretive, and there's so much we don't know, I feel like the movie doesn't really fill in those gaps for us or even try to, and so we're sort of left with a biopic about somebody whose own bio is still a mystery.
Well, the whole thing, like, I was not a big fan of... J. Edgar. I'm not a big fan of Changeling, and in both cases, Eastwood takes these historical stories full of mystery and tells them in the most plain-spoken way possible. Mm. Like, the Changeling...
With stunning period detail, though.
With stunning period detail and that beautiful brown medicinal view that looks like homework.
Yes.
I mean, like, I was thinking, watching the Changeling, I was thinking, give this to somebody like Guillermo del Toro, who can find, like, a kind of dark, magical realism in it. You know, have the returned boy played by the same actor as the original boy.
And so that we're not sure. Yeah.
And so we're not sure, as opposed to just watching Angelina Jolie go, give me back my son, until it becomes a drinking game. With J. Edgar, you know, so much of that guy is off the record, and you can see so much possibility. Like, imagine a J. Edgar Hoover film just about the Lindbergh case, which we see a lot of.
Yeah.
Which was the case where, A, he worked it with a real devotion, and B, it gave him so much power. You tell just that story, you've got a film. You try and fit 50 years, 70 years of a man's life on the screen, you've got a Wikipedia page wearing makeup.
Yeah, I mean, Christine Lemire, when we were doing it on What the Flick this week, she said, you know, maybe they should have just done the Motorcycle Diaries route. You know, give us one early chunk.
I love that as a biopic. Even Ali, which I think is a really underrated biopic, pretty much keeps you within a three-decade span.
Yeah, that's true. It doesn't try to do...
It doesn't do the whole Ray, walk the line, or at least walk the line ends at a certain point.
Right, right.
You know, the worst thing you can do in a biopic is try and get everything up in there, because you run into serious narrative problems. And yeah, if you're going to try and do that...
And if the person was interesting enough in the first place to merit a biopic, doing their entire life is so chock full of stuff that you've got to do the, like, some 9-hour, you know, miniseries or French movie to really do justice to it all.
I really think there's the other thing is that, I mean, and again, because so much of his stuff is not known, I do like Milk. And I think that Milk is a great portrait of historical, of political activism as you lose until you win. Because it's him repeatedly failing and still getting up and going back to the polls and going back and going back to the polls and getting up and going back to the polls. The other thing is that there's a scene in Milk, and you'll have to pardon my language, but it's Diego Luna and Sean Penn in bed.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just talking really quietly, and they are spattered in passion.
Mm-hmm.
They look like they have been doing it and then talking about constitutional freedom, and doing it and then talking about human rights until they get hot again, and then doing it and talking. It looks ridiculous. And you compare that with J. Edgar, mm-hmm. where the only moment of sexuality is an attempted kiss,
right,
and then another kiss given after a fight by two men with bloody lips, and you think, why is Clint Eastwood so afraid of sex?
Well, actually, here's the thing, though. I will give J. Edgar its portrayal of gay sexuality, because I suspect that that's probably about as much as Hoover ever allowed himself, given the historical context, his role as a DC insider and a law and order guy. I totally bought that he would completely, like, suppress and tamp down his sexuality, that he kept Tolson around because of their close emotional bond, but that the two of them, for various, you know, societal and personal reasons, we're probably too terrified to really take it any further. So, I mean, you know, for all that's wrong with J. Edgar, I actually bought that. And it didn't feel to me like, you know, The Color Purple, where, you know, Seeley and what's Shug, her face, Shug, yeah, kiss, and the camera goes out the window.
Right to the curtains, yeah.
Exactly. To me, this felt like, this is probably about as sexy as Hoover ever got.
What's really interesting in a movie like J. Edgar is that it brings out all of your friends who have wild conspiracy theories, in that, or you start doing research, and I read that Roy Cohn, the noted mm-hmm. HUAC lawyer, who Hoover recommended to McCarthy,
right,
who later in life came out of the closet.
Yeah, not so much. He basically he got AIDS and was sort of, I don't even know that he really officially came out as right. such.
But he always said that he believed Hoover was asexual,
uh-huh.
completely obsessed with power and control, and would not, in fact, be able to lose himself in any capacity for passion.
Sure.
And then you talk to a friend of mine who's a big James Ellroy fan, and says, does Clint Eastwood's movie mention how that the Mafia had a picture of Hoover going down on Tolson? I'm like, this picture is real. Why do you think he never went after organized crime? Well, I can't say. I didn't know it was because of the Hummer picture, you know? So with all this stuff in the mix, and again, it's Clint Eastwood, you know? It's Clint Eastwood who can find a way to make anything less interesting than it is. And also who is, who's intriguing prickliness about sex in his earlier career in films like Play Misty for Me, sure. and The Beguiled, and even Tightrope, which is creepy.
Yeah, very, yeah.
Has gone even from being that kind of creepy scared to just like, we don't talk about it here. There's this clenched-lipped kind of American Puritanism.
I don't know. It's a tough call because, you know, believe me, my radar for, like, directors who are taking the cowardly way out is finally honed over my years of being a homo who likes movies. But in this movie, I will give it to them because Hoover could very easily be... I buy the Roy Cohn theory, and I don't necessarily dispel the Mafia conspiracy theory either, but I think that in telling the story, it didn't clang in the way that so many movies do, you know, your Fried Green Tomatoes, say, you
right,
know,
where
there's just clearly a thing going on that they don't want to address, you know.
I will say this, I have a chance to talk to Armie Hammer.
Uh-huh.
And A, good-looking son of a B.
And I think the best thing in this movie.
Especially in his early performance, as early Tolson, where it's like, is that illegal? Like, it comes within a nickel of Paul Lynn territory, but at least it's a spark of life. Mr. Hoover! And as a hetero with many homo friends who really likes movies and is squeamish about when people take the easy way out, Hammer mentioned that he got his personal research to dig up everything.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing he found that really, like, gave him an insight was the fact that Hoover had photos taken of Tolson while Tolson was sleeping.
Hmm.
Now, you and I get along, Alonzo. I am never going to take pictures of you while you're sleeping.
And I appreciate that.
And I would like to think that you would extend me the same courtesy.
Sure. Yes.
Anyhow.
Yes, of course.
Fine, fine, sure. I'll sign off on that. But seriously, that speaks to a level of intimacy and want.
Sure.
That, like, and your Armie Hammer, you clearly mentioned Mr. Clint Eastwood. How do you not put that scene in the film for depicting the strangeness of it all? And the answer is that strangeness frightens Eastwood.
No, I Grant, I mean, I agree with what you're saying about Eastwood. And I would, the thing that you hear about him, though, is that he finds scripts that he wants to shoot and he shoots them. Like, he pretty much, you know, doesn't muck about with the scripts he's given. And that's obviously for better or worse, as we can, over the course of his career.
On time and under budget. Yeah.
Well, exactly. So I'm thinking that what we see is as much a product of what Dustin Lance Black wrote.
Right.
As Eastwood. And I, you know, Black's whole thing as a screenwriter has been gay, 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 you know. So I can't imagine that he would have edited himself on that front.
But I feel like he went from five gays in your gay, 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 to maybe just like two. Gay?
Gay.
Gay. And I don't know. And the other thing that makes me mad is that J. Edgar is yet another political film that blows the lid off of things that happened 50 years ago. Mm. I had the luck of being able to see Luc Besson's The Lady the day after J. Edgar. Oh. And for all of which is about Aung San Suu Kyi,
right.
The Burmese political leader who was under house arrest for nearly 20 years.
Wow.
And as stilted and as occasionally borrowed from Douglas Sirk and Victor Fleming, The Lady
Ooh,
feels.
I can't wait.
It is about something that is happening in the here and now. And I was able to walk out of that film, write my review of it, and give my writing fee to U.S. Action for Burma. I was able to do something, as opposed to these museum piece, dusty, historical dioramas. Like, Invictus. When Clint Eastwood made Invictus, I was like, wow, way to blow the lid off of the fact apartheid was bad 20 years ago.
Well, I mean, the thing is, sometimes a movie like that can, you know, that's about the past can be relevant because of the cyclical nature of history.
And, yes, you know, but if you're willing to make it that way.
Sure, no. And I mean, like, I think, like, you could do a movie now about, say, the labor movement of the 1920s and have it resonate with the Occupy Wall Street people. I mean, I don't think period pieces in and of themselves are a bad thing, but you're right. A lot of these movies, they do feel kind of moth-eaten, and
they feel like we're designed to appeal to the quote-unquote liberal sensibilities of Academy voters who were liberals in the 1950s and are now just 800 years old and occasionally drinking the blood of the young people to stay alive.
Which means that in about, 50 years, we'll get the Dick Cheney movie, you know?
I hope not. I hope not. Again, that was the whole thing with that. It was nice to go see The Lady and be like told, Aung San Suu Kyi is still in a boatload of difficulty. You have a closing title, and go like, this is a movie with the fierce urgency of now.
Right, as opposed to being ripped from yesterday's headlines.
Right.
I hear you. No, and as one of the things I really love about this gig is how you will see a movie that completely changes your perspective on another movie that you just saw. Like, I remember going to see Cowboys and Aliens and thinking, well, you know, it's not despicable. It's okay.
I like Cowboys and Aliens a lot more than other people.
Well, okay. Yes. And I was sort of, you know, it's all right. It's fine. It's got its moments. And then, like, 2 days later, I saw Attack the Block. And I was like, okay, forget Cowboys and Aliens. This is how you do this movie.
This is how you do B-movie thrills with unlikely people standing against alien invaders.
Exactly.
Done. Yeah, I can totally buy that argument,
by the way. But, yeah, so I can see how seeing something like The Lady, as imperfect as it might be, at least feels relevant and pressing and contemporary, none of which J. Edgar is.
Right. And also gives you the chance to say, hey, lady!
Flavin.
Glady.
Speaking of Jerry Lewis, Adam Sandler.
Do you think the French consider Adam Sandler a genius? I didn't see Jack and Jill. I wasn't even invited to the press days for it.
Mm.
The only thing I have to comment is that judging by the posters for Jack and Jill, the most psychologically interesting thing about that film is that it demonstrates that, yes, just like us, Adam Sandler hates Adam Sandler. I really feel like there's a psychological chasm there where Adam Sandler's like, well, they all hate me. I hate me. Let's give him a version of me everybody can hate and have fun with.
I just remember, I mean, when that trailer first came out, it was like, remember in Funny People?
They have all the fake movies where he walks on a baby or he's a merman.
Yeah.
Totally looks like a funny movie fake film.
It totally looks like, yes, exactly. And so I thought, oh my God. And, you know, because Sandler has lowered the bar so much, since I've already sat through Just Go With It and Bucky Larson, Born to Be a Star this year. Jack and Jill was less awful than either of those. That's, you know, that is my qualified thing. It's terrible still. It is full of the usual sort of Sandler mix of inane scatological humor, as opposed to funny scatological humor, which does exist, and, like, the sappiest sort of, like, family is important homilies,
if,
you know.
If you ever want a great demonstration of why exactly the San Francisco Chronicle's building should be burned to the ground, bear in mind that their film critic, Mick LaSalle, considered Click one of the best films of a year.
Oh, God.
Because it had that whole maudlin thing and the
family is what's important.
Bring me a canteen full of poop.
Yeah.
The thing is that, again, when funny people failed, I just thought,
that's
America,
it.
America, you asked for it. You asked for it. Funny People is an amazing film.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
It meshes almost perfectly with my concerns in Zen studies. And it's a 2.5 hour long goddamn movie where the last shot is somebody doing the first selfless thing they've done in a long time. And you've seen every step they have taken to get there.
Mm.
And you should walk out of a theater fist pumping. And instead we get Jack and Jill.
Yeah, I know. And it's sort of like, you know, every so often Sandler will make a, you know, a Punch Drunk Love or and this was a flawed movie, mind you, but I'm glad that he made it at least, with Spanglish.
There's a lot wrong with Spanglish.
Yes.
Punch Drunk Love, great. If you said to me, you can have Adam Sandler back making movies like Bulletproof, where he's something on the plate instead of the main course.
Right.
I'd be ecstatic. Sure. I would love to see a Marlon Wayans Adam Sandler action film right now, as opposed to Adam Sandler and Adam Sandler.
And I'll tell you, but for all the things that are wrong with Spanglish, the fact that it was directed by Dennis Dugan is not one of them. So there's at least that.
That whole Sandler mafia. Can we get some kind of Rico thing going where they're clearly colluding?
Yeah, no, I did a list for movies.com of, like, these people's careers are Adam Sandler's fault.
Frank Caracci.
Dennis and
Dugan.
Nick Swartzen. Alan Covert. Rob Schneider. I mean, the list goes on and on. It's insane. Now, what I will say about Jack and Jill that makes it a tiny step above the other Sandler misfires of late, Al Pacino. He's really funny in this and has a really, I mean, he's basically doing the Neil Patrick Harris routine of, like, playing this grotesque, exaggerated version of himself, but he's doing it Pacino style, and it's really quite funny. And I would say, whereas for most Sandler movies, pretend you never heard of them, hide behind the sofa until they go away, watch Jack and Jill on cable, like TiVo it, and fast forward and just watch the Pacino scenes.
There are a lot of films where I'm not fond of them, but there are specific combinations of actors and subplots that I can watch the hell out of. The first example I can think of is So I Married an Axe Murderer, where Mike Myers is capering, grows incredibly tired.
Right.
Anthony LaPaglia and Alan Arkin as a cop and his too sensitive captain, and the cop wishes the captain were tougher, and, like, I've been trying to cost to file paperwork, want to run over roofs, how come you're never telling me the commissioner's mad at my crazy antics? Well, Cop Eddie, we don't have a commissioner. We have a board who oversees the police action here in San Francisco. Some of those people are elected, some of them are appointed, some of them serve ex officio.
Wow, you know this really well.
You're not really helping, sir. Because it's a great, hilarious sequence. What happens is Arkin goes away and studies how to be a proper
movie
TV
cop, right, yes.
Movie cop.
Turn in your badge.
Look, it's Spaghetti Bender, get down to the docks. Yeah, and, like, knocking his feet off a desk. And then going, was that too much with the ethnic thing? No, sir, I liked it. That's an example. If you're telling me the Al Pacino stuff in Jack and Jill, maybe someday when I don't have much to live for, and it's very rainy, and it's on cable. Yeah.
Or even, like, you know, if the Pacino scenes turn up on YouTube after the DVD comes out, if they aren't there already, you know, seriously, his bits are worth watching and made me laugh. And even his interactions with Sandler in drag suddenly lifted the movie to this other level of, oh, so this could be this, but it so rarely is, you know.
Right, yep. Well, you know.
But yeah, the argument I made in my review online was that you know, he already had the fart jokes and the homilies, and now that he's added drag to the mix, Adam Sandler is now officially Tyler Perry.
Of course, Adam Sandler is still showing his films to critics.
That's true. Yes, he hasn't completely crossed that line.
Unlike Ty Ty Pepe. What else is in theaters we need to talk about?
That's it this week, I think, as far as the... I mean, that's all I reviewed this week. Is it, did you any indie stuff?
Not really. I mean, if you're still... I'm sure you've said this already, but if you're still looking for someone to see, go see Martha Marcy May Marlene.
Oh, yeah. No question.
One of the best American films of the year, one of the scariest films of the year, and completely driven by naturalistic performance and great storytelling.
You know, since we have some time, why don't you explain to me and our listeners why you don't like Weekend?
Weekend just felt like a very standard let's meet, let's talk take on Before Sunrise with almost no filmic virtues, almost no cinematic virtues. The whole thing of like, let's shoot with some reflection of the tile or the coffee makers when I got up and left. I didn't like the characters. You know, there's a whole great line from, I think it's W.B. Du Bois, that the state of the arts in African America is such that the only tools available to the critic are not the pom-pom and the baton. And I had heard people raving about Weekend as this beautiful, funny, modern gay love story, and I literally walked out of it halfway through. So if it does some kind of reversal and becomes amazing, I'm sorry for being so short-tempered.
Okay. Well,
but the whole thing, and apparently I left even before the cocaine came out, which would make it even more intolerable. But I just left Weekend thinking, if I'm supposed to be happy that gay and lesbian filmmakers are making movies just as inadequate, weak, tiresome and cliche as a straight dominant paradigm, I'm not really going to have much of a victory party for that.
Well, see, here's the thing. The first time I saw it, I loved it. And I thought to myself later, okay, did I love that because I loved it, or did I love it because it was less awful than the parade of horrible gay and lesbian feature films that I've seen over the last few years as a festival programmer and as a critic? And I saw it a second time, and it's like, no, this is a genuinely good movie, even outside of the parameters of it's a good gay movie. Like, it's a good movie, period, for me.
I did not like its shooting style. I didn't like its acting style. And...
see, I completely went with those performances. I thought the characters were really interesting. I felt like I hadn't seen people like them before. I didn't even really make the Before
Sunrise... You mean Uptight Guy and Sybarite? You've never seen those characters
not
before?
Not in the way that they were portrayed in the film, and not in the way that they described their own lives. And also, if you left early, you missed layers that come later to those guys.
I am sure that I did, which is, you know, I never wrote anything about Weekend. I've never said a disparaging word about it in public until now, because I don't feel like I have a basis of it.
Okay.
But I know it's a film you're very high on.
I am.
That enthusiasm made me roll my eyes a little.
And I didn't even think about it in terms of Before Sunrise. I was frankly thinking of it in terms of Romer.
Oh, that movie wishes it could be Romer. Romer is, just... I don't know, Weekend just felt really clangingly obvious and really ugly.
Wow, really?
Yeah, and just unattractively shot and really devoid of cinematic... It makes the trip look like Tree of Life.
Oh, come on. No. I'm sorry. I thought the cinematography was spot on.
Nah.
I thought it gave it a naturalistic feel, but it still felt it had a certain... you know, I thought there was a real beauty to it. So
Here's the thing. We've all seen a lot... You know, as festival programmers, as good liberals, we've all seen a lot of gay films that are just gay and not in the happy sense.
Sure.
The difference is, are they well made? Like, for example, Pariah. I have seen Pariah 1,000 times before, but there's something about that movie where it's really well made, really well done, how it just burrows into her and sticks with her.
Mm-hmm.
Weekend is a story where I've seen it 1,000 times before, and nothing in the first half of it made me go, wow, this is more than just 1001.
Well, you know, I would say if time allows, we are supposed to be getting screeners. Maybe give it another shot.
Just got my Mysteries of Lisbon screener, so there goes a week.
Yeah, no, I know. I got that too.
to not joke about a 4.5-hour long movie.
Right.
I'm always willing to give the film another chance, especially predicated on the wisdom and enthusiasm of people like you. At the same time, that was my immediate reaction.
It
could have just been bad timing or, you know, high pressure weather front or me just being a goofball.
I mean, look, we disagree, but I always respect your opinion. I knew that you weren't just sort of dismissing it out of hand. I was genuinely curious as to why it didn't work.
And just as your fondness of it did not make me want to give you a two-handed Kirk slap. You
know? Your Bible is a lie.
Why is a mouse when it spins?
So, DVD pick of the week. What do you got?
There's two great things coming out next week, and I know that your pick on Tuesday is the same as my alternate pick.
Okay.
So I'm going to go with my main pick, and that's Bellflower, one of the most interesting American indie films from this year or in years. It's technically interesting, shot on a shoestring, but more importantly, it is visually and thematically stylish in a way so few films are, and deliberately challenging. It's the story of two friends who came out to California on pretty much a whim. They live in an underpopulated, underattractive section of LA. Mm-hmm. Their big dream is to prepare for the apocalypse by building a car with a flamethrower in it and various other weapons. And when the apocalypse comes, they will be totally set. They will have their social and political footing. And then one of them meets a girl and falls in love, and everything goes terribly wrong. It was shot on a digital camera, but they built a hand-constructed front for it that looked like an old-fashioned accordion cloth camera where they could remove pieces to let in more light and change the focal length of it, essentially turning the CCD of a digital camera into the glass plate that would front a traditional 1900 movie camera.
Right.
It looks amazing. It's got a great soundtrack, strong performances. And the other thing is that a lot of people reacted negatively to this film as, oh my God, it's just about these guys who hate women. And I don't think it's about that. I think it's a movie about these guys who are terrified that they may hate women and not know how to break it.
I actually read you, I think you tweeted that or something before I saw it, and I was thinking about that as I was watching it, and I kind of see both sides on this one, because for me, I agree with you. Technically, it is an extraordinary movie. I love the way it looks. I love the fact that they built their own flamethrowers and they built all that stuff that's going on in the movie. I think it's a really interesting portrait of these two kind of emotionally stunted characters.
Yeah.
For me, the narrative falls apart a little in like Act 3 or so.
Because I think it's supposed to, a little bit.
I think
that because of the thing, the film does essentially show you one iteration of What If.
Sure.
Before cycling back to a rest point where none of the horrible stuff we saw in What If happened.
Right.
First of all, I'm sorry. You know, this isn't theaters. You could have seen it already. But I do feel like it has to go to a really ugly place before it hits the reset button. And I think that ugly place is really discomforting for a lot of people.
No, absolutely. And I don't begrudge it that. And I think that part of it works. I would have to see it again to even remember my exact objections to it. But I just remember thinking, I really admire a lot about this film. It doesn't all work for me.
Right.
But I think totally people should see it. I want to see what this guy does next, certainly.
Yes. I think it's the most interesting portrait of youth and young manhood since Fight Club, in terms of being both an analysis, a celebration, and a critique.
Sure, yeah, okay.
Also, the DVD is amazing. It comes in a combination Blu-ray and DVD package. Plenty of extras. Beautiful design from the good folks at Oscilloscope.
Oh, great.
This is a great, great DVD package.
Cool. Well, speaking of which, as you mentioned...
Yes, you actually physically have this here.
I have both versions of the West Side Story 50th Anniversary Edition that comes out on Tuesday. I love the holiday time because they really get aggressive on these DVDs with all the stuff.
They want your money.
Oh, yeah. So now here are your choices. There's a 3-disc set, which is a Blu-ray and DVD, and the Blu-ray extras include this, I find very exciting, a song-specific commentary by Stephen Sondheim, who does not generally...
take part in these kinds of
things. Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I guess he's got a couple of books to sell now, so maybe he's working it. So that's kind of cool. There's, you know, some documentaries about making the film, some storyboards,
nice.
You know, with the montage and comparison of how the movies came out. Or you could really go buck wild and get the 4-disc set, which comes with a hardcover book with photos, foreword by Walter Mirisch, who produced the film, who passed away recently, if I recall correctly. You know, postcards with international theatrical posters, and it's a 3 discs from the 3-disc set, and then they toss in a CD of cover songs from the film, including Julie Andrews doing "I Feel Pretty." I'm maybe a little less excited about Tuck and Patty's version of One Hand, One Heart, but, you know, to each his own. So anyway, yeah, this is, you know, one of the great American musicals, and, 50 years old. We also just recently lost Arthur Lawrence this year, who wrote the book. And, you know, it's, for all of its flaws and for the arguable miscasting of Natalie Wood and whatever else you want to pick at it, this is still, you know, visually a stunning movie. Jerome Robbins' choreography pops off the screen.
One of the great American musicals and also one of the great American musical films. There's a couple of films where, you know, West Side Story, I mean, it's not in the same league musically, but Godspell, the film, takes great advantage of New York.
I have... I love the Godspell movie. Really? Every okay. Easter, I tape it up. I tape it up TCM, and I watch it. Yeah, you're right. That is one of the great locations. You that and On the Town, or those are probably like the troika three, of New York musicals. The troika
of New York musicals. West Side Story, certainly among them.
Yes.
Great looking stuff. Great song.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would rent or watch a bejabers out of this. So yes. And that's it. Next week on the big screen, we get Breaking Dawn. Part one. I had a great moment at a press conference where I actually asked Stephanie Meyer about the sexual politics of those books.
Ooh.
It was great. I just said to Ms. Meyer, some critics have suggested that the sexual politics of the Twilight films are a bit retrograde, and considering what we spent last night spending 2 hours watching a young woman have sex once, get pregnant, and nearly die from it, that may be the case. what would you say to those critics? And she said, you know, I don't really think about politics, but I just think about how, you know, 100 years ago, if you were pregnant, that meant you could very well wind up dying. It's a bravery, like soldiers have, and we just don't have that. So it's like, yeah, Stephanie Meyer, nostalgic for Civil War era medical
technology. And midwifery.
So Stephanie Meyer would like you to forego anesthetic in order to prove what kind of woman you are.
I'll tell you, I never thought that I would be in any way looking forward to the last of the Twilight movies, but the words directed by Bill Condon have definitely upped the ante.
This movie's frickin' crazy. There's 2 hours of setup.
I was going to say, it's like, it's a part one.
It's 2 hours
one,
of setup, and it feels remarkably like a telenovela. Hmm. And everyone keeps on talking about imprinting, like that's how werewolves or vampires fall in love. But it just sounds like suspiciously like you're eavesdropping in Scientologists. It's a very queasy book. And when Edward has to inject Bella with his vampire venom, which is a pearlescent white fluid that you then see in 3D floating around her body, coating every cell of her form, you're like, really? The Twilight films now officially function as pornography for people too squeamish to understand sex. And as comic book movies for people without the courage and convictions to say, hey, I like superheroes.
Well, there you go. All right. Well, Dave and I will be seeing that one this week and talking about it next week. James, thank you so much. You've been a great guest.
Alonzo, thank you so very kindly for the pleasure of having me on the Millennium Knights. I know Dave. You know, 1 second.
Also next week on the big screen. what else is playing?
The Descendants.
Alexander Payne always makes white people hurt, and I like him for that. It's like very quiet death metal.
All kidding about Dave aside, thank you so kindly for having me. You can find my work at jamesrocky.com, my personal site, or at MSN Movies, at movies.com, at Box Office Magazine, at IndieWire's The Playlist, and at the Toronto Star.
And that's James Rocky, ROCCHI.com. I wanted to give a quick shout out, as always, to our friends in the podcast universe, the Popcorn Mafia, the Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli, Blowhard, the podcast, Criterion Cast, Fat Guys of the Movies, Secretly Timid, Glitter in the Garbage, The Schmoes Know, and a new podcast this week that I want to let you know about from the very funny Aaron Gibson and Brian Safi. You know them from Current's Infomania. They have a new podcast on iTunes called Throwing Shade. You will want to check it out. Christmas is coming up, folks, and nothing makes a better stocking stuffer. Nothing in the world makes a better stocking stuffer than my book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, available on Amazon and lots of places where books are sold. If you would like to order an autographed copy directly from me, we would be happy to work that out with you. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. You can also write us there with any questions, comments, or whatever else. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter, LinoleumCast. Check in with us on Get Glue. And if you're a fan of the show and you haven't done so yet, why not drop by iTunes and give us a review and let people know that you enjoy the show? It'll help others find us.
I'm just going to say one thing. If several thousand years ago the baby Jesus were being born in a manger, the three wise men would forego myrrh, which is like, what, a gum resin? And get a copy of Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas for you from Jesus. It's the right thing to do.
It's Magi approved. Thank you, James. Again, thanks for joining us. We thank you at home for listening, and we will be back next time. Bye.